to Pasadena and to the United States Court of Appeals, our courthouse here in Pasadena. The matter set for our argument is Mackenzie Brown versus State of Arizona and Richard A. Rodriguez, U.S. Department of Education. The parties are ready to proceed. You may come forward and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Alexandra Brodsky for Appellant Mackenzie Brown. If I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. A school has control over the context of sexual harassment if it has the practical power through its disciplinary authority or otherwise to reduce the risk of harassment in the context. That functional standard best accords with both Davis and the statutory text. Title IX, among other things, forbids a school from subjecting a student to discrimination, quote, under the education program or activity. That's the statutory basis for the control over context requirement. And Davis, looking to contemporary dictionaries, told us what under means. Under means under the regulatory authority of. It doesn't mean within, as the university seems to assume. Elsewhere in the statute, Davis also specifically forbids sex discrimination that excludes a person from participation in or denies them the benefits of the school. And another problem with the university's miserly reading of control is that it forecloses liability for forms of discrimination that are plainly prohibited by those portions of the text. One illustration of this is the hypothetical from our supplemental brief adapted from Davis of a school that's deliberately indifferent to harassment by a group of boys who stand right in front of the schoolhouse gate and harass girls to stop them from entering the school. The university's reading of control would prohibit liability in these circumstances, even though we know from the statutory text that that's one of the principal evils that Congress sought to root out with Title IX. And I want to underscore that even in that hypothetical, the school is only liable if it had actual knowledge of the harassment, if it was deliberately indifferent to the harassment, and the harassment was so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive.
Counsel, forgive me. I know you have lots that we'd like to say, but what has troubled me about this case is even if you take the approach that you are doing, the record, as I understand it, shows that the Title IX office was fully aware of the abuse by Mr. Bradford of Student A and Ms. DeGroote, but that was never passed on, as I understand it, to the coaching staff. If that's true, even if you take the university as being the culpable party, Justice O'Connor in the Davis case made it very clear that in order to reach the deliberate indifference standard, you have to have a person who knew about it and then was deliberately indifferent. What I'm troubled about is that the people who had the power over Bradford had his scholarship, they approved his living off campus, they had the ability to discipline him in many other ways, and of course terminate his being in the university. They had the power. But they didn't know. So if they didn't know, how could they be deliberately indifferent? I know you're going to say it's the university's responsibility, but that's not, as I understand it, what Justice O'Connor said. You've got to have a person who's deliberately indifferent. So help me, please. How do we find the university to be deliberately indifferent when the people that had the power to discipline didn't even know about it?
Your Honor, you've anticipated that part of my response would be that the knowledge is attributed to the university as a whole, but even if we take it person by person, the Title IX office did have significant control over the context because it had disciplinary authority. It could initiate the investigation that might have resulted in Bradford being suspended from the school, expelled from the school, and thus removed from the context of university life altogether. But it also wasn't only the Title IX staff that had knowledge. By March of 2016, the university's Dean of Students, Senior Title IX Investigator, and Title IX liaison to the athletics department had notice of abuse of student A. The senior Title IX investigator also told an associate dean about abuse of Mr. Groot. In April 2016, the Title IX liaison athletic director and dean of students learn about Bradford banging at student A's door for hours.
Let's assume that's correct, and I think for purposes of your pleading, we have to do that. So they have that knowledge. But are you suggesting that the Title IX office alone had the ability to terminate scholarship, kick Bradford off the campus? Is that correct?
So there are multiple different kinds of control at issue here. So I think that the focus has been on the athletic-specific control, in part because it's so direct. The team literally had the ability to tell Bradford, you cannot live in that house, to revoke his scholarship. But there are also other kinds of control, including the university's control to institute a disciplinary investigation, which certainly the senior Title IX investigator and the dean of students and the associate dean in charge of student discipline would have been in a position to implement.
And in so doing, they would have avoided deliberate indifference. Is that your position?
So to separate out deliberate indifference and control here, Davis was clear that schools have a range of potential remedies at their disposal, that a plaintiff isn't in the position to say, no, you have to do just this one thing that I want. But I do think that if the university had initiated an investigation into the abuse of student A, Mr. Groot, had done a reasonable investigation, that would have been enough to avoid deliberate indifference.
Well, part of the problem is they didn't take what was the most obvious step. They didn't tell the football team, even though it was pretty obviously what the football team would have done, and we have uncontradicted testimony from the head coach that what he would have done, but they kept it to themselves. The only thing they ever told the football team about was the banging on the door.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And, you know, I think that means that even if we look at actual knowledge and deliberate indifference in a person-by-person version, the best version of this story for the university is that the administrators tasked by the university with ensuring student safety from sexual violence and compliance with Title IX failed to do the absolute most basic thing it could have done, which is to say, hey, coach, you have a huge amount of control over the life of this young man. You should know what's going on here so that you can keep an eye out for it. So that, at the very least, creates a jury question as to deliberate indifference.
What's odd about it is they did tell the coaching staff, but the only thing they told the coaching staff was they banged on the door, even though at that time they knew a lot of really bad things about him.
Yes, that's correct. And I think that really underscores the deliberate, indeliberate indifference. That this is, you know, Davis says that a school is deliberately indifferent when its response is clearly unreasonable under the known circumstances. And it seems like in this situation, the university almost went out of its way not to be helpful, not to take...
What's your best illustration of deliberate indifference in this case by the university?
I think that the university's utter failure to do literally anything to protect the larger student body once it knew about both the abuse of student A and the abuse of Mr. Groot.
But if the head of the Title IX office knew about the first two terrible treatments, that by, I can't remember the his or her failure to have Mr. Bradford terminated as a student of the university, that in and of itself is sufficient deliberate indifference, in quotes, to state a cause of action in this case?
I don't think it's the failure to expel him, Your Honor, because, again, Davis doesn't allow a plaintiff to say there's only one solution here.
I understand that, but I'm just giving me one. Give me one that you say is an example. I'm really empathetic to what happened. This is a terrible, terrible thing. But Davis is pretty clear, in my judgment, that you got to have individual people who know about this and are deliberately indifferent, and that's what I'm looking for. Who's the person or the persons, even if it affects the university, who was deliberately indifferent in this case?
I promise I will answer that directly. If I may just foreground what deliberate indifference is. So Davis says a school is deliberately indifferent when its actions are clearly unreasonable under the known circumstances. So the known circumstances here being the knowledge of Bradford's past abuse. And a school is certainly deliberately indifferent when it does nothing. A number of courts, including the Fourth Circuit in the Hurley case, which is the Yik Yak harassment case, has said that a school is also deliberately indifferent if its response is not calculated to end the harassment. And that's a formulation that the Sixth Circuit has endorsed, the Second Circuit has endorsed. And here, I think that there are a number of individuals for whom we can say, senior Title IX administrator, doing literally nothing to stop Bradford from harassing others, not even as much as telling his coach what's happened, going out of your way, perhaps, to only give incomplete information, that to give a sense that what Bradford has done would not require his removal from a team. That's deliberately indifferent.
Counsel, does your argument address the context requirement in Davis? Control of the context?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think how does the deliberate indifference?
How does your argument address the requirement that the university control the context of the injury vis-a-vis this particular plaintiff?
Yes, Your Honor. So as we've explained, a school has control over the context of harassment when it has the practical power to reduce the risk there. And the university here had multiple forms of such power.
So what case are you relying upon to support the argument that the university controls the context when it has the power to over the individual?
Your Honor, there are a number of cases, including the Fourth Circuit and Hurley.
What's your strongest case to support the proposition that the university has control over the context when it has control over the individual perpetrator? What's the strongest case for that argument?
So if I may clarify our position, it's not that in every single circumstance when a school has control over the individual, it will automatically have control over the context. But it is that disciplinary control over individuals, the ability to regulate conduct, is one way that a plaintiff can establish under certain facts.
Have anything else other than the fact that the program and the coach has pretty extensive control over the perpetrator?
Your Honor, that would have been
another other material question of fact that would warrant a remand for purposes of trial. Is it the fact that he's on scholarship and presumably the funds were being used to pay for the apartment?
Your Honor, there are a number of different sources of power here. So
tell me the facts, the triable questions of fact that would demonstrate control over context. You've talked extensively about the control over him as a football player. What else do you have?
The school had the ability to determine who was living in that house and what they could do in that house. It also had the ability to...
What's the question of fact? Where in the record is a question of fact on that the university had control over who lived in that apartment?
So we know from 2ER54 that the coaching staff had the ability to determine whether football players, including Bradford and the other people he was living with, could live off campus or not. We also know that they had the power to investigate what happened in that house from 3ER365. And of course, the school ultimately did regulate the conduct in that house by initiating an investigation. As to whether there's a question of fact, I think it's plausible that McKenzie would have been entitled to summary judgment here, but all this court needs to find at this juncture is that it is a jury question whether the school...
But you're not relying on the scholarship.
We are as well, Your Honor. Apologies. Yes, the scholarship was one of the ways that the school was able to determine whether...
So the denial of his right to live there, denial of permission of his right to live there, the scholarship money. Is there any evidence in the record that scholarship money was being used to fund his rent?
So, Your Honor, I think that the best, the university has not disputed that in any of its filed briefs, and I think some of the best evidence there.
I'm trying to figure out, we send it back for trial, how do you prove that?
That how would we prove that Bradford had paid his rent?
So which witness would you call? How do you overcome any potential hearsay problems?
Sure. I think that Ms. DeGruy would be a good witness on that because she helped him apply for the apartment, and if there's ER-121, she talks about her understanding that he was using scholarship funds to pay for that. And if I may, I would like to reserve my time
There's also a text entry where they say between Ms. DeGruy and Ms. Brown that he couldn't afford to go to the University of Arizona without a scholarship.
That's correct, Your Honor. And Ms. Brown's expert said that as a general matter, when athletes, elite athletes on this kind of scholarship are kicked off the team, lose their scholarship, they leave the university entirely.
Wasn't there also testimony from the football coach that they would regulate what happened in a off-campus apartment with regard to not smoking dope, not underage drinking, don't do drunk driving? So there were a lot of other restrictions that the athletic department, the football coaches, imposed on these off-campus residences. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the university says, well, when describing the kinds of conduct that the coach looked for to determine if a player was behaving well off-campus, that the coach didn't specifically mention gender violence, but I think it is a fair inference that a coach who would require someone to move back on campus because he was a couple minutes late to class would also take action if he found out he had tried to murder his
girlfriend. Let me ask you, it seems in your briefs, although you are mentioning it today, that you're not relying as much on the summary judgment standard, that all reasonable inferences have to be drawn in favor of the non-moving party, or that the standard is just whether there would be any reasonable fact finder that could find in your client's favor. Why is that? Do you want to have, you don't think that's that important in this context, or?
I think that it is certainly important, Your Honor, because all that Mackenzie needs to show is that there is a dispute of fact. All of the evidence should be viewed in the light most favorable to her. I think perhaps the reason why we didn't rely heavily on that is because there's a lot of undisputed evidence that shows control. But it's certainly true that this should ultimately be a jury question, as is often true for matters of degree. And
another thing you didn't address in your briefs is the forfeiture argument. You appear to have disclaimed your theory. Could you address that?
Sure. So we haven't abandoned the earlier argument, but our focus is now on the control that the school had over the football house. And this court has repeatedly held that it can reach issues or arguments that are raised for the first time in a petition for rehearing en banc. One recent case for that is Hernandez-Estrada, 749 F3rd, 1154. Here, the case now comes to this court having been fully briefed. And this is actually the scenario that in Socop Gonzalez versus INS, this court said is a particularly appropriate one for the en banc court to reach the issue, where the argument isn't briefed by the parties, but the panel reaches it. They get the law wrong. A party asks this court to go en banc to resolve that issue, and the court does so. At that point, it makes sense and might, in fact, be affirmatively encouraged, the opinion says, for the court to reach the issue in that circumstance.
I know you're trying to save time. I'll give you some time, but I have a question for you. Given the university's exceptional control, level of control over Division I athletes, is there any limit to the university's liability for Bradford's actions?
Yes, Your Honor. So some of those are just very clearly built into Davis, that the school would not be vicariously liable for his abuse absent deliberate indifference, actual knowledge, showing that the harassment was so severe and pervasive as to affect the victim's education, as it clearly did in this case, really putting it at the heartland of Title IX. But I'd also say, to perhaps use the university's hypothetical about an assault between two students that who randomly come across each other in Alaska, and there's no tie to the school, I think that even if the assailant in that circumstance was a Division I athlete, you might not get control there. But that's certainly a case on the edge of control at best. And here, as you know, there's a really remarkable amount of control, putting it at the heartland.
Yes. So is it your position that for Division I athletes, the context element of Davis will always be met because of the control they have over the scholarship?
No, Your Honor. And I think that goes again to the Alaska hypothetical, where there's nothing that the school could have done with the scholarship or otherwise to keep two students from randomly running into each other out of state in the way that the university describes in its hypothetical, where it's really gone out of its way to write out any tie to the school, any causation to the school. But to the extent that the university bristles at the idea that perhaps it might have a greater degree of control over a house full of Division I athletes and a house full of non-athletes, that's only a reflection of distinctions that the university itself decided to draw in its own regulations. That is, the university has decided to regulate more closely the lives of athletes, including over their living arrangements, than over non-athletes. And the court doesn't have to ignore those facts, especially at summary judgment.
Chief, if I may ask one question.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned scholarship as perhaps evidence of control over the context of abuse or harassment. But as a practical matter, it does seem a little bit odd that the university could be held liable if the student is from lower income and thus receives a scholarship, but may not be liable if it's a trust fund kid who is an abuser, and therefore the university doesn't offer him a scholarship. And they're kind of an odd result by just relying on the scholarships as context of harassment.
Your Honor, I think what's important here is the scholarship is simply one more degree of control. We're talking about control over context as a matter of degree. The scholarship gives a couple more points, but I think even without the scholarship, the school would have enough control over this context, because to my mind, the relevance of the scholarship is that by revoking the scholarship, the university would have greatly reduced the chances that Bradford was living in that house, living in the context of university life writ large, but the university also had a more direct way to effectuate that result, which was either tell him he has to live on campus or expel him from the school altogether, and both of those forms of power would be available over the trust fund kid as well.
You know, I've lived with the universities for many years of my career. If he had not been a football player and he'd been charged, and we'd had already the conduct with respect to student A and to Groot, he would have been kicked out, period.
I think that that's probably correct, Your Honor, and we see the results of that.
Judge Sung, did you have any questions? Judge Sung's appearing by video. No? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jason Lee for the United States as amicus. This court should reverse the district court's ruling and hold that a school's disciplinary authority can, in certain circumstances, demonstrate a school's control over the context in which harassment occurs. Arizona errs in arguing categorically to the contrary, that disciplinary authority can never satisfy control over context. That would mean that where a school knows that a student is being sexually harassed off campus and has multiple disciplinary actions that it could take to prevent that harassment, there would not even be the possibility of liability under Title IX.
Can I ask, just under your client's position, the Department of Education, I think it wouldn't matter where the abuse occurred in terms of a geographic location, as long as it was perpetrated by this individual. Is that a fair statement or no?
Geography is not determinative, but it's certainly relevant. For example, the location where harassment takes place can inform a reasonable juror or a court's determination of whether or not there's control over context. Let me give an example. A school's disciplinary authority over a student necessarily will depend or will change if the student's in campus housing versus...
I'm sorry to cut you off. Just in this case, though, under the position you've staked out, it seems to me it would not matter if the abuse had occurred, 100% of it had occurred in the car, parked outside the house, or parked at a gas station 5 miles away, or, you know what I'm saying? The position you've staked out, it seems to me, is much broader, and it suggests that as long as the school has disciplinary authority over this individual, that's going to be sufficient. But if that's wrong, I'd love to hear your response.
No, we're definitely not taking a categorical position that disciplinary authority always will suffice, but that it can in certain circumstances. And at least here, the types of disciplinary action that could have been taken by the school suffice to at least create a jury question on substantial control.
These arguments seem to go to control over the individual, which I didn't understand was in dispute. We're talking about context. It can't be that these two tests are the same. So how is just control over the individual distinct from context in your view?
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. They are distinct, but they are also trying to get at the same fundamental thing, which is did the school have some reasonable action it could take to prevent the harassment from taking place or at least reduce the risk of harassment? Now, to get to your more fundamental question, are these two factors distinct? Yes, they are. But they can't be pulled apart and totally isolated in the way...
Everything you're saying goes to the first factor. And so, I mean, every argument I've heard so far suggests that if you meet the first factor, you also meet the second factor. So I'm trying to... Give me an example of something that would meet the second factor but not the first factor.
would meet substantial
context, but wouldn't satisfy. Well, I guess you don't have to say that it wouldn't satisfy, but what would only satisfy the second factor, you know, the context?
For example, many universities rent out their campuses for summer camps. In that context, the school might have substantial control over the dorm where a private camp is taking place, but they wouldn't necessarily have disciplinary authority over the campers themselves. I want to make this very, very clear. This is a context-specific analysis. By definition, you're looking at a school's substantial control over a particular context. There are certain times where a school can derive control over a context because of the people that are there. For example, a school might not own a fraternity house, but they can say, Saturday, 10 p.m., no alcohol will be served, because in that context, there will be individuals there who are members of the school university. It's put on by members of a recognized student group, and it will be hosting an event that's open to the rest of the academic community. So the fact that these two factors can, in certain times, overlap, that's also not remarkable under Davis. Under Davis, many of the factors overlap. For example, the ability to take corrective action. That informs whether or not there's actual knowledge by a qualifying student individual, like Judge Smith mentioned. It also goes to whether or not a school's response was deliberately indifferent. So the fact that some of the factors may overlap, they may try and get at the same thing, that's not unremarkable.
Well, help me understand under the facts of this case, what demonstrates control over this off-campus apartment, the ability to deny permission to live there. What else?
If I could take 1 second to set the stage and then get into those facts. What we're looking at here is, one sentence, what we're looking at here is whether or not there's sufficient indicia of control, and the form of that control doesn't necessarily matter. It's what the school could have done. Here we know the school had some exercise over Bradford's off-campus conduct. There's the code of conduct that explicitly applied off-campus. That's what was told to student A. You had regulation of his off-campus conduct in the no-contact order, which was expressed in saying it applied off-campus. You have the school's specific finding in expelling him that his conduct posed a danger to other members of the academic community, including on campus. That's all with the university. You independently have alternative basis with the football team's regulatory authority. They conditioned, not only did they subsidize his ability to live off campus, but they conditioned it on certain restrictions on his conduct, and they had a categorical rule that you cannot engage in any type of assaultive behavior against women. Those are all independent basis that a reasonable juror could conclude could demonstrate substantial control by the school, that there was some reasonable ability by the school to lower the risk of harassment.
And what's the government's best example of a person employed by the university that was engaged in deliberate indifference in the context described in the Davis case?
We don't take any position on actual knowledge in this case, but I think your question, Judge Smith, is insightful because it recognizes that it's the other factors of Davis that really do the heavy lifting here. Those are the factors that impose reasonable limits on liability, and case law certainly bears that out. All we're asking here is whether or not there's a threshold indicia of control showing that this harassment occurred.
I get that, but again, to your point about Davis, it seemed to me that Justice O'Connor's opinion was very careful. They want to be sure that they're not throwing the entire educational institution into a situation where a little here, a little there, and all of a sudden they have enormous liability. They wanted to be certain that you had people who knew what outrageous thing was going on, and that that person, empowered person, was deliberately indifferent to what was going on. And that's what I'm struggling here. My colleagues have pointed out, in terms of the context, if you had somebody in a car or whatever, it's far more difficult because they wouldn't know about it. It gets more into the individual stuff that actually happened in the Davis case. And that's what I'm struggling with in this case. You've got people in the one department who seem to know some things. Is it the government's position that anybody in the university community who had knowledge and who did not report it to somebody who had power to change things was deliberately indifferent? Is that your position?
No, that's not our position. And again, we don't take any position on actual knowledge in this case. But one of your questions, I think, gets to some of the concerns that were raised by Judge Watford, which is the extent of this theory of liability. I mentioned earlier, you know, this is just a threshold function, a threshold question in the analysis. It doesn't give rise to liability, I want to make very clear. But in terms of kind of the limits of disciplinary authority and control, really all we're asking this court to recognize is that schools have broad discretion in how they set up their operations, the types of conditions they can place on participation in their programs and activities, the scope of their operations. All Congress did was to say in Title IX, however you choose to set up your operations, Title IX applies in that context. And the operations of, for example, an online-only school, a virtual school, is going to be very different than the type of a control exercise, the type of disciplinary authority at hand for a traditional school. And so all we're saying is the limit really is what has the school exerted substantial control over, in what types of contexts, what types of student conduct, is it interactions between students, is it conduct that's going to put other members of the school body at risk, which is the exact type of policy the University of Arizona had here. And so all this court would be recognizing is a couple different points. First, you know, it's whether or not the harassment occurred under a school's operations. And second, whether or not there was some reasonable ability.
If the test is so fact-specific and has to be determined on a case-by-case basis, how can schools have a good sense of when there might be liability and how they're supposed to, you know, modify their conduct to avoid liability when it's this fact-specific?
Again, schools have their own discretion in terms of how they set things up, what type of programs they're going to affiliate with, what type of on-campus programs they're going to offer versus off-campus programs, what type of guarantees do they want to make sure that their schools their students have. So it's just recognizing that if you're exerting control over certain types of on-campus conduct, off-campus conduct, then you need to make sure this, in a pre-assault case that you're responding not clearly unreasonably. That's all that Davis recognizes. And I think that's the important part of this fact of this case, that we're dealing with a pre-assault claim. So that's for two reasons. First, we know that there was some knowledge by the school of a heightened risk of sexual harassment. And in that context, all the school needs to do is act not clearly unreasonably. The second relevance for the fact that this is a pre-assault claim is we have evidence of what the school did in response to that knowledge. It did a variety of different things. It issued a no-contact order saying, you know what, you cannot interact with this student off campus, thus showing some restrictions of Bradford's conduct in an off-campus context. They also exercised control over where he could live. When they issued that no-contact order, they said, you have to move dorms. We need to keep you away from this person to whom you pose a significant risk. And so, again, the fact that this is a pre-assault case, a pre-assault claim, provides some indicia of control based on what the school did in response to that knowledge.
Does the department have a view as to which factor is perhaps most important?
Any
likely to be dispositive?
I think there's at least five bases on which to find substantial control, and I mentioned that here a little bit earlier. The no-contact order, the code of conduct.
So nothing is more dispositive. I'm saying in general, not necessarily specific to this case.
We don't take a position on, you know, which one is the most forceful basis here, but at least in the totality of these circumstances, at the minimum, there's a jury question.
Again, the facts here are bad for the university because I think there's, you know, a lot of evidence that Bradford had committed abuse against other female students, but supposing cases where one student is accused of abuse or harassment, but that student strongly denies it, and maybe it's a little bit murky, I mean, wouldn't the government's position create an incentive for universities to basically expel students who've been accused because there's potential liability, and the easiest way to avoid liability is to expel the student? And, you know, ultimately, to universities, large universities, one student being expelled isn't a big deal.
No, Your Honor. The universities have a number of reasons to do exactly what the school did here, which is regulate certain types of off-campus conduct. And if I could just give a quick list, of course, that schools want to ensure a safe learning environment for all students. There's the fact that off-campus harassment often will have an impact on the on-campus environment, and schools have an interest in protecting the on-campus environment. Schools also have an interest in protecting the integrity of their off-campus programs and activities. There's also the regulatory interest to make sure that schools respond to off-campus bullying and harassment that was discussed by the Supreme Court in Mahanoy. And then I think all of those provide good reasons for the school to for schools generally to do exactly as this school did here, which is restrict types of off-campus misconduct which poses a danger to the physical safety of other members of the academic community. Unless there are any further questions, thank you for the time. This court should reverse.
I have a question.
Oh,
I'm
sorry.
No worries. I'm wondering if the department has a definition of the term context. And I asked in part because Plaintiff argued that, you know, the court used the term context interchangeably with the word environment. And when I read Davis, right, there's nothing in Davis that suggests to me that physical location is the definition of context. It is a factor. It is a circumstance. And even the dictionary definition of context just says context means the overall circumstances in which an event occurs. So I'm wondering, how would you define context?
Yes, Your Honor. Context, as you said, is not geography. The Supreme Court did not say location. They purposefully used a broad term, context, and that can include geography, but it can also include time. It can include who the individual's with. It can include the type of interaction that's being regulated by the school. It can include historical context. It can include past practice by the school or its officials. So, yes, it's definitely not geography.
Is geography to be considered at all?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, as I mentioned, a school's control over a student will differ depending on if he's in an on-campus dorm room or if he's his parents' house. So that's baked in.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Stephanie Elliott for the State of Arizona and the Arizona Board of Regents. Mackenzie Brown was not assaulted in the context of a university program or activity, and she didn't argue that she was until she petitioned for rehearing. This court should affirm the judgment below for three independent yet equally dispositive reasons. First, the dissent's argument that Brown has now adopted regarding control over Bradford's off-campus residence is not properly before this court. Second, even if the argument is considered, it fails under Davis. And third, even if the argument could survive under Davis, it fails on the facts of this case. And I'll discuss each in turn. First, entertaining the argument that Brown has disclaimed throughout litigation but has adopted now only during the rehearing would be in direct opposition to the Supreme Court's recent ruling in Sinning Smith. Brown's argument was first presented by Judge Fletcher in his dissent in the now vacated opinion, but she expressly disclaimed that theory every step of the way. And I'd like to point quickly to one sentence of her opening brief from page 20. She says, here the Title IX violations alleged by Mackenzie are in the nature of intentional failure to correct known on-campus harassment, not intentional failure to prevent assaults in off-campus housing. Yet that is what she argues to you here today. She went on to say that the question is, quote, not whether it had sufficient control over the context in which she was later attacked. Yet that is what we are here discussing today. She's adopted this new argument now, but this wasn't the case that was presented to the district court, and it wasn't the case that was presented to this court in briefing or in oral argument.
Now, are you resting your argument on the Supreme Court's case in Sinning Smith?
Yes, Your Honor, I am, but also on the general case law saying that this court does not entertain arguments that were waived below, that it does not generally entertain arguments that were not presented in briefing, or arguments that were, in this case, not just waived, but forfeited.
Let me first ask you about Senator Smith. As I'm sure you know, what happened there was the three-judge panel invited three amici to submit briefs on issues, not just arguments, but on issues that had never been raised by any of the parties. And Justice Ginsburg's opinion really talks about not waiver, but about the panel violating the principle of party representation. Now, here we're talking about an argument that was not made, or rather an argument that was made in a much broader form than the argument that I advanced. We've got case law that says, well, you can waive a claim, but if the claim is the same, but it's a different argument, you don't waive the argument. How do you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor, the argument was not made in a broader sense.
I'm asking you the following. We have case law that says you can waive a claim, but if it's the same claim, but the argument under the claim is different, the argument is not waived.
Ms. Brown is not really making the same claim. The claim that Ms. Brown made throughout this litigation was that the university was deliberately indifferent to the harassment that Bradford inflicted on women before her, and that the basis for liability on the university was the actions it allegedly did not take in response to those assaults. That's a different claim than the claim she alleges now, where she seeks to hold the university.
The basic claim is a violation of Title IX. Then there are arguments as to why Title IX was violated.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that her claim has shifted from the claim that was initially litigated. And the importance of that, which does go to the reasoning in Sinning Smith, is that the deviation from the party presentation principle, it speaks to fairness and neutrality, but it also speaks to the prejudice of raising a claim now that was never litigated all through this case. Discovery was not targeted at this claim because it was never made. This argument was never made until now during the rehearing. And part of the problem with our factual record, and when we ask questions about what are the facts in the record, what facts support these arguments, they were never developed by either party because this argument was never made.
But in Sinning Smith, the overbreadth argument was overbreadth claim was never asserted by Sinning Smith. So there wasn't any sort of morphing of an overbreadth claim, as you say there has been here. Is that right?
The overbreath claim was not raised in Sinning Smith. That's correct. But it was what the court discussed in Sinning Smith was that the panel had injected, and I believe the words used in the opinion were that the panel had injected a new argument into the appeal. And this argument also made its way into the appeal after the initial panel had unanimously rejected the argument that Brown made initially. And for that reason, this panel should be looking at this case and analyzing this case from the perspective of Brown's initial argument, which was that she need not show control over the context of her own harassment.
So aside the forfeiture question for a moment, can you address the control over context? Mr. Lee and Ms. Brodsky extensively discussed the breadth of the disciplinary authority, including the decision as to where Bradford could live.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Now, why aren't these questions a fact for the jury? Whether he wins or not before a jury is a totally different question.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, every fact, every element of control that Brown has put forth and that the United States, the Department of Education, puts forth goes to the control over harasser element. In Davis, the Supreme Court went to great lengths to cabin the range of actionable misconduct to suit the text and the purpose of Title IX. And part of the way it did that was to set these two separate control elements, which have related but separate purposes. And the purpose of the control over the context element is to tether liability to the text of the statute.
But there's substantial overlap. So the facts could demonstrate both control over Mr. Bradford as well as control over the context in which the abuse occurs. For example, determining where he gets to live, the ability to move him back to campus, the funds that may be used to pay for his apartment, et cetera. So how do you deal with those facts? And specifically, I go back to, again, the summary judgment standard. Why aren't these questions a fact for the jury to decide?
Your Honor, my answer has two parts, sort of a legal part and a factual part. So the legal part is that those factors, respectfully, do not necessarily overlap. Those factors that you're describing give the university control over Bradford. They don't give the university control over this off-campus residence, which is the context in which Ms. Brown was abused, not just because it was off-campus, but also because it had no connection to any university program or activity. My factual answer to that is that the viewing the facts, or let me actually go back to the way that Brown has described the control over the context element as whether or not the university, through its disciplinary authority, has the power to reduce risk in that context. So the problem with the way the facts have been characterized here is that it's been put forth that the university had some ability to actually prohibit Bradford from living in that residence. It did not. The testimony regarding Coach Rodriguez's football team rule indicated that it was related only to players meeting their academic and team obligations. First, there's nothing in the record to indicate Bradford didn't meet those obligations. But second, and maybe more importantly, is what that rule doesn't do. It doesn't give the authority to tell him he had to move out of that house.
Is the control over context only a location-based inquiry in your view then? Or can we consider other facts?
It is absolutely not simply location-based, Your Honor.
So what would you say the other facts we can consider for the context?
Control over context is not based on geography. It is based on actual control. And I think you can look at other cases.
Control of what?
Over the context of the abuse. In this case, the context of her abuse was this off-campus residence that was unrelated to a university program or activity. But I think you can look to other cases to see examples of control over context. For example, in Hurley, the court found that there was control over context not because the school had the ability to discipline the harassers. It found control over context because the harassing messages originated on campus. They were transmitted via the university's Wi-Fi network or servers. They concerned students and on-campus events. And the court found that the school literally had control over that context, even though it was cyber harassment.
In Davis, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Supreme Court repeatedly pointed to a school's disciplinary authority as a key criterion for assessing whether the school exercises substantial control over the context of harassment. So why shouldn't we look at the disciplinary authority to determine the control over context issue here?
I think that in Davis, the Supreme Court did not actually say that disciplinary authority was a key to control over the context. In Davis, the court had first gone to great lengths to set the two control elements. It easily found control over context in Davis because it happened on campus during school hours. It addressed that in a short paragraph. It dispensed with it quickly. It then went on to discuss the control over harasser element in the sense that it was holding that vicarious liability was not pertinent and astute or was not applicable.
I'm seeing here, it says Davis emphasized that the standard was sufficiently flexible to take into consideration, quote, the level of disciplinary authority available to the school. And they go on to say, we thus conclude that recipients of federal funding may be liable for subjecting their students to discrimination where the recipient is deliberately indifferent to known acts of student-on-student sexual harassment and the harasser is under the school's disciplinary authority.
Correct, Your Honor, but that portion of the opinion came after the Supreme Court had already found the control over context element, and it was discussing then how the school could have control over the harasser, culminating in that sentence which indicated that there is control over the harasser, particularly when a school has disciplinary authority.
Can I ask you a question? The university issued a no-contact order as to student A, which applied to Mr. Bradford off campus. So it seems like the university understood that it had some control over his conduct when he was off campus. Isn't that right?
Correct, Your Honor. The university has disciplinary measures that it can impose that do reach off campus, but that doesn't give the university control over the context of anywhere a student could commit misconduct. There are generally code of conduct provisions or sports team rules that will apply to students even in the off-campus context. But if that were enough, then...
And your position is those are never enough. A football player rule 15 that regulates an athlete's conduct, that could never be enough in addition with the disciplinary and remedial power that the school has, as well as any funding that the school may have in allowing that individual to live off campus.
Code of conduct rules or team rules that apply to player conduct go to the control over harasser element.
Counsel, we're talking in terms of context, but I want to get back for a second to the Davis concept of deliberate indifference. What is the university's, the state of Arizona's position about whether there has ever been any deliberate indifference in this case? Your colleague on the other side has not given me an answer, and the government says they're not going to do that either. Is it the position of the state of Arizona, and specifically the university here, that there was no incident where the university or anyone employed by the university committed deliberate indifference? Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position, we argued it below, and we also argued it in the initial appeal, is that the district court's ruling could be affirmed on that basis as well. And in this case, it's important to note that before Ms. Brown reported, which is the relevant time period that we're talking about here, the information that the university had was limited to information regarding student A and some limited information regarding a possible second victim. The university addressed and remediated student A's concerns while respecting her wishes to not participate in a university dean of students or Title IX investigation. The Department of Education, during their argument, pointed this out as well. The university took several steps to remediate the notice that it had about student A, and it did that to her satisfaction.
Both students, as I recall, at least initially, declined to do anything. Is that correct?
Student A declined to move forward with the university investigation. The second student, Ms. DeGroote, did not report to the university. The university attempted to look into some reports that it had, but she did not report to the university. But as to student A's, the university wasn't deliberately indifferent. It took the steps available to it while respecting her wishes, and it took the steps that did indeed remediate her concerns.
So at the very least, from your perspective, deliberate indifference, at least as Justice O'Connor described it, was basically an outrageous failure to take an action that was demanded under the circumstances. I gather that it's the state's position that, at least with respect to these first two women, that what the university did was not of that nature. They may have been able to do it a little bit better, but it wasn't deliberate indifference. And what happened to Ms. Brown, which is a horrendous thing, was not something that they would necessarily have forecast, and that they could not necessarily have been held liable for that. Is that your position?
That is correct, Your Honor. And not only could the university not forecast what was going to happen to Ms. Brown, but it couldn't have done anything to prevent that. What we've discussed today repeatedly...
Wait a minute. What do you mean they could not have done anything to prevent that? If they had reported it to the football coach, we have uncontradicted evidence from the football coach that Mr. Bradford would have lost his scholarship and he would have been gone from the university. So they could have done something. Now, the question as to whether they have an obligation to do it is a different thing, but you say that they couldn't have done anything. That's not true.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that cascade of events that you've described where it's reported to the football coach and various things that happen after that are based on several layers of speculation that are not supported in the record.
Always based on what the football coach said.
The football coach's testimony in the record was, of course, he was deposed after the fact that he would have kicked Bradford off the team. That is what's in the record. The coach whether or not that would have resulted in Bradford's loss of his athletic scholarship or expulsion, that is a different story. There's nothing, no facts in the record that go to that because that argument had not been made below. But what we do know is that he would be entitled to due process before either of those actions were taken. And with the reports that the university had at the time, whether or not those would be successful, maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't. But more importantly, even if Bradford was expelled from the University of Arizona, that does not kick him out of his house. His house was privately owned. The university could not regulate who could and couldn't live there. That was, he leased it from a private owner. They couldn't set...
But he could influence whether he had any money to pay for it.
Potentially, but the only...
Not, what do you mean potentially? He was on scholarship.
The only thing in the record, Your Honor, though, is that he had a scholarship. The record doesn't contain any details about the scholarship, and the record doesn't contain facts indicating that he necessarily paid his rent with scholarship money as opposed to money he got from somewhere else.
Is that another example of facts that were not developed below because this argument wasn't raised, so you would have never had a reason to develop it below?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. Presumably, both parties would have developed additional facts below had this ever been the disclosed legal theory, and it wasn't. But the record doesn't have facts indicating if he paid it with his scholarship money or
I thought
money.
There was evidence in the record, and I think Judge Cole referenced one piece of evidence earlier in the text.
There is not actually evidence in the record that he paid it with scholarship funds. Both, I think.
He couldn't afford to live there otherwise.
Sure. The two women that had dated him, texting back and forth, said that they didn't think he could afford to live there otherwise. But Ms. DeGroote also testified in her deposition, and this page is in the record, that she assumed he paid for it with scholarship funds, but she didn't really know. And there was, the record doesn't indicate there's any basis that that would be admissible or that that's anything other than her personal speculation. But also, and perhaps more importantly, Brown has not presented any case law indicating that the university has substantial control over anything and everything paid for with scholarship funds. And indeed, the implications of that kind of ruling would be far-ranging, not just for Title IX, but for negligence generally.
If I could, counsel, hypothetical, I'm trying to understand the difference between the context and control. A law school dean, or comes to the attention of a university president, that a law school dean has been harassing women at a law school. The university president sits on that information, doesn't take immediate action. Then the law school dean invites a young woman up to his off-campus apartment, which is paid for through the contract between the university and the dean, and mistreats her in the apartment, off-campus. Under your reading of Davis, would the school be on the hook?
I think, Your Honor, that I can't totally answer that without knowing all the facts, but I think it would be a closer call. If there was evidence that the university could regulate that context, I also think it may be different because he's a teacher, but aside from that.
he's a professor, and
sure.
But the relationship, but that's not, it's the context is what I'm getting at.
Correct.
But the context matters, an off-campus apartment that the school pays for because he's the dean of the law school.
I think that it would be a closer call and that there additional facts would have to be developed to determine if the university had substantial control over that context, given the facts that you state, if the university could regulate that apartment, if the university could, for example, kick him out of that apartment, tell him he couldn't rent it anymore. Those things could be indicia of actual control over that context.
And but you're saying you do imagine a situation where those are the facts and the university would not be liable, even though the dean of the law school is abusing people in his apartment and they're on notice. And you're saying there is a scenario you could see where the school would not be liable under Title IX for that.
If the school does not have substantial control over the context in which it occurred. But again, that would be so fact-specific, I fear I can't give a totally accurate answer to your question.
Here, Bradford's coach, I think it was referenced earlier, immediately kicked Bradford off the team once he learned that Bradford sexually assaulted Brown even though the assault occurred off on an off-campus residence. Why doesn't that show that the university had control over the context of this assault?
That shows that the university had the ability to discipline Bradford. It shows...
Why can't it show both?
Because the elements are separate, and the ability to discipline Bradford, they would have the ability to discipline Bradford for assaulting a woman no matter where he did it. But that doesn't give them substantial control over if he did it at his parents' house or in a hotel on spring break or over the summer. It wouldn't give them substantial control over those contexts either.
But that's why we look at the context and the facts here. I don't know. I'm trying to figure this out. But here was... off campus, but the coach then kicked him off the team once the abuse occurred, even though it was off campus.
Correct, Your Honor, but respectfully, that still goes to the control over the harasser element, and you would have to show something different to show also the control over the context. The reason being, because the school can't be liable unless this harassment is occurring under its education programs or activities. And having disciplinary authority over students, even when they commit some kind of misconduct potentially off campus, does not mean that their misconduct is now occurring under an education program or activity.
All right, so if to follow up on my colleague's question, if Bradford had abused Ms. Brown at his home, wherever that happened to be, and the coach found out about it under their rules, you could have still kicked him off the team, right?
Correct.
So it didn't really matter where he was at that time.
Correct.
That gets to the context. And I think you said earlier that he would have had due process, so that under Arizona's rules, if he were kicked off the team, there would be a proceeding that would occur in which the school would say, we want to remove the scholarship, and he could then defend and to see whether he could keep it. Is that right?
There would be a proceeding. I don't exactly know the details because none of that is in the record,
right,
because this was not something that was litigated below. But I do know that there would need to be due process. There would be proceedings, and he would be entitled to those constitutional protections just as any other student would.
And the fact that what he did to Ms. Brown occurred, then he was kicked off the team. I don't know how long it takes to get people out of a rental in Arizona, but it would be some period of time in where that property would almost be irrelevant in terms of at that point, right? It isn't the property, it's the context in which it occurs. Is that correct?
His off-campus residence, unrelated to a university program or activity, is the context where this assault occurred. As far as him getting kicked out of that property, I don't have any information on that because it was owned by a private owner who theoretically could have let Bradford live there whether or not he was a football player or whether or not he was a student at the University of Arizona.
Actually would have lost the control over the context, because the flip side of this is, oh, well, it's the football rule that says you could live off campus. Well, if you expelled them from the team, kicked them off the team, then they would have had no control over the context. So aren't we just imposing like a zig and a zag here and just, you know, trying to take Arizona to the bank when there's nothing about the context that's raised here?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think that Brown is attempting here to use Title IX to combat all harassment that occurs between students.
Well, counsel, in your view, if there had been definitive evidence through discovery below that the university, in fact, paid for this apartment, would that be a different case?
If the university... No, I don't believe it.
Scholarship funds paid for the apartment, and there's definitive evidence of that developed through discovery.
No, I don't think...
closer case?
Sorry, Your Honor. No, I don't think that would be a different case, because there's still no legal authority that says that the university has substantial control over everything purchased with scholarship money. Practically, that would put the university in the position of having...
The better question is, what if they gave scholarship money that was specifically... I don't know if you do this, but it was specifically designed to cover housing. If they said, we're giving you the... What if they gave a housing statement? and you couldn't use that money unless it was for housing, that would be control over context, wouldn't it?
I don't know if that's a thing that's done, and I don't know if it would necessarily be, because I think still, and maybe that would be a fact that could be considered, but it would still depend on whether the university actually has control over the context. And I think
I asked that question because Judge Owens gave the example of the university dean in an off-campus apartment committing misconduct with young women, and you said, well, that's a really would be a much closer case. So if you were to, or if the plaintiff were able to establish that university funds, let's say he got a full ride, tuition's completely covered, he got a stipend for living expenses, and as part of living expenses, he's paying for this off-campus apartment. How would that be any different than the university dean in school-funded housing example?
Well, because I think, as I think I stated in response to that hypothetical, it would depend not just on whether the university is paying for the apartment, but whether it has control over it. Can it regulate it? Can it kick that person? Can it kick the dean out of that apartment and say, "Oh, you violated a rule"?
There's regulation here. Let's say that he has evidence that university funds pay for the apartment, and they can yank him out of that apartment back to on-campus housing.
That's actually not what our factual record indicates. Coach Rodriguez had some level of influence over him if he didn't meet his academic or his team obligations. But even if Coach Rodriguez could discipline him within the context of the football team, he cannot force him to move out of that house. He can't force him to move into a dorm. And the reason he can't force that is because he doesn't have control over the off-campus housing. Again, this isn't in the factual record one way or the other, but Bradford could say, well, you know, forget it. I don't want to play football anymore. I want to live in this house. And that owner can say, great, live in the house. And the university can't do anything about it because it doesn't have the control. It doesn't have the authority to do anything about him living in that house. And that's the reason that this...
If I might interrupt, when it comes to physical violence, physical abuse, I mean, does the control or the context really matter that much as a practical matter? I mean, here in this case, Bradford abused two women to four in dorms. It seems like the university didn't have much control over it or regulate or do much about it. So whether it occurs in a dorm or a private, apartment, does the control over context matter that much?
I want to address that with two parts, and the first is, yes, control over context does matter. The Supreme Court set the control over context elements specifically to make sure that liability was staying within the text of Title IX, which explicitly requires that actionable harassment occur in a program or activity of the university. It is an important element. It has an important purpose that is not served by the other elements, and it is required by the Supreme Court. The second part of my answer just addresses that they did take action upon learning of the first two women. They took the action that they could take and the action that was appropriate under the guidance that was in effect at that time to remediate the effects on student A. They did take that action, which also goes to the deliberate indifference portion. But control over context is very important, and it is a required element, and it is... see that my time is running short, so if I may just go ahead and
make a concluding statement.
Thank you, Your Honor. Brown's argument expands and distorts Title IX's private right of action under Davis to cover far more conduct than was intended by Congress or the Supreme Court. She's attempting to use Title IX as a weapon to combat all sexual harassment that occurs between students. But our argument fails under controlling law, and it fails on the facts of this case. The district court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Come forward. I'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate the time. I'd like to clarify the claim, clarify the standard, and talk about deliberate indifference. The claim in this case has always been a pre-assault Title IX case that the university's deliberate indifference to Bradford's past abuse of other women, of which the school had actual knowledge.
I agree that you didn't advance this argument below that Judge Fletcher adopted and that now you're latching onto, right?
The argument wasn't, but that didn't...
But then discovery was conducted, and no discovery was done geared towards this. If this goes back down, they are forced to go to trial, not having had the opportunity to prove some of these things that we're latching our attention to.
That's not correct, Your Honor. So first of all, there was no motion to dismiss in this case. So the university had no idea what arguments McKenzie was going to advance during discovery. And indeed, the university's briefing below is all about whether the university had control over the context in which McKenzie was abused. As to the standard, I just want to clarify because the university slightly misstated the standard. It's not a school may have control over a context if its disciplinary authority gives it the power to reduce harassment in the context, but there are other ways that a school can also exert control, and the Hurley case from the Fourth Circuit that the university mentioned is a great example. Not all of the harassment there happened off campus.
So you won't be surprised that I want to go back to deliberate indifference, which to me is determinative here. The as has been pointed out with student A, when the Title IX office found out about this, they notified the coaches. The coaches had suspended Bradford for 3 days. They had lessons about drinking. That was the problem there. So they did do something with respect to student A. With respect to Ms. DeGroote, I don't have the timing on this, but they apparently were in the process of doing something when something occurred with Brown. So, again, I want to help. I really want to help, but I need to know who committed deliberate indifference here. Outrageous acts by Bradford. No question about it. The issue of the context, I won't go over that again. But at the end of the day, even if you have those two things combined, draw over him and the proper context, somebody has to have committed an act of deliberate indifference, and I'm asking you, who did it?
The Dean of Students knew that Bradford had seriously abused both student A and DeGroote, and I would note that the district court actually affirmatively granted Ms. DeGroote summary judgment on the university's deliberate indifference, and yet the school did literally nothing to protect the rest of the student body. And the Department of Education has repeatedly recognized, most recently in a 2021 question and answer document, that as a general matter, a school should try to respect the wishes of a past victim about whether to proceed with an investigation.
So the person you mentioned, that's your best case, right? So if we can't find deliberate indifference with him, you lose?
I think that, no, Your Honor, because I think there are multiple people that the university does not dispute were appropriate persons, which is the relevant standard for whether their actions can be
committed deliberate indifference based upon the knowledge they have vis-a-vis Bradford.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I would just note that we don't know what Leo would have wanted to do because no one bothered to ask her. And the Department of Education has noted that at a certain point, a university has a broader responsibility under Title IX to the larger student body to protect them. And just to leave you with the ramifications of the university's position. At page 17 of its supplemental brief, it says that under its version of control, a university could affirmatively encourage its students to engage in off-campus sexual harassment of their peers that disrupts their peers' educations, and that would be actionable under Title IX. That can't be reconciled with the text, and that cannot be reconciled with the purpose and spirit of Title IX. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brodsky, Mr. Lee, and Ms. Elliott, thank you very much for your oral argument presentations here today. The case of McKenzie Brown versus State of Arizona Board of Regents and Richard A. Rodriguez, U.S. Department of Education, is now submitted. Thank you very much. Return.